You can listen again to any shows at bcfmradio.com and leave comments about your favourite programmes. BCFM 93.2, your interactive station, 24 hours a day.
As the Bristol Babies Heart scandal reared its ugly head again this week, as the coroner's critical of UHB NHS Trust. Well, we asked Daphne Havercroft from Southwest Whistleblowers Health Action Group, who was at the inquest. Also, the Police Federation. We have Kevin Phillips here from the Avon and Somerset Police Federation to talk about potential review of the entire organisation. And flooding in the Somerset Levels. Well, at least there's plenty of water about to keep the nuclear power station cool, but has enough been done to drain them? And we hear from former US Marine Ken O'Keefe on the programme he was making in London about the 9/11 attacks. That's the show. Our guest from Sweden last week, former IBM employee and journalist Chris Bolin, was due to appear on when he was detained at Heathrow Airport and then deported back to Sweden. Plus, Martin Summers takes us on a tour of the world's hotspots, and we'll look at the Syria talks as well as Ukraine and Kiev. We start this week by looking at this inquest. I'm joined by Daphne Havercroft, who's from Southwest Whistleblowers Health Action Group. Hi, Daphne. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello, Tony. Thanks for inviting me on the show.
Now, first of all, what's the background to the Bristol Children's Hospital introducing these high dependency beds on this notorious Ward 32?
Well, I think if you look at what's happened, they were shamed into doing so. Because two boys died on that ward in early 2012. Luke Jenkins, whose inquest was held at the end of last year, and Sean Turner's, whose inquest concluded yesterday. And both parents were not happy with the quality of care that their sons had received. They asked the Care Quality Commission to go into the hospital and have a look at what was going on. The Care Quality Commission found that there were shortcomings in staffing levels, and the hospital introduced high dependency beds, I think, earlier this year. But they knew they needed high dependency beds.
Yeah, so why didn't they have them before? That seems the obvious question.
All the evidence that we've seen, the documents we've seen, indicate that the commissioners had not put forward money for high dependency beds pending a decision being made as to whether Bristol would remain one of the safe and sustainable centres for paediatric cardiac surgery, because the recommendations of that review back in 2012 were that there should be 7 centres around the country. There are 10 at the moment. Whether it'll ever get down to 7 is not clear, but the money was not going to be forthcoming for Bristol until they got safe and sustainable in the bag.
So what about the allegation made by one of the mums yesterday that two of these higher dependency beds weren't being used simply due to shortage of nurses?
Well, that's a bit worrying, because the coroner's verdict, she did say that there were some missed opportunities in Sean Turner's care, but that she didn't go on to make a prevention of death report. And so she's accepted, I think, the Trust's confirmation that, yes, they've made a lot of changes. But we're not sure what these changes are, because we've got hold of a document which goes back to 2001. And it's quite a weighty document, about 20 pages. And it's called High Dependency Care for Children, Report of an Expert Advisory Group for the Department of Health. And this lists not only the facilities, equipment, drugs that you would need to have a high dependency unit, but that you would need clinical leads, what the nursing levels would be. So I think to just put in several high dependency beds is a bit of a cop out. What we would need to know is what are the standards now, 12 years after this report was issued, and how well is Bristol meeting them? And just having some high dependency beds, and maybe from what we're hearing yesterday, maybe still not having enough skilled staff to be able to support high dependency. We really need to know what's going on at that hospital.
Now, I'm going to be a bit cheeky and read out something from the Eye, because I think it's very relevant. It wasn't online for some reason, but it's in the Eye newspaper, analysis by Charlie Cooper, one of their reporters. His headline is, "The Simple Explanation, This Is All About Funding Cuts." It doesn't relate directly to this, but it's a general thing in the health service. In the past year, he says, many things have been blamed for the problems affecting the NHS, the ageing population, GPs, contracts, absentee doctors and uncaring nurses. But all the while, the people on the front line of our care services have been crying out a simple message. It's the money, stupid. Today's report from the King's Fund starkly shows how right they were. The NHS is facing a funding crisis. Spending from central government has slowed down dramatically in the recession, to the point that the NHS trusts are tasked with finding a huge £20 billion of efficiency savings by 2015, time of the next election. Even within a total budget that exceeds £100 billion, that's incredibly hefty. Economists at the King's Fund now say it's unlikely those savings targets will be met. What does it all mean? In a taxpayer-funded system, won't hospitals that just can't balance the books be bailed out? Well, yes, he says, to an extent. But if a trust is consistently going into deficit, the government has the power to appoint a special administrator who has the power to reorganise or reallocate services or even close wards. The government's seeking to increase these powers so that administrators can make decisions that affect all the NHS trusts in a local area, not just the ones that went into deficit. For an example of the fury this can provoke amongst local patients, you need only look at the case of Lewisham Hospital last year, where Jeremy Hunt suffered a bloody nose over plans to shut wards, despite it being a neighbouring trust that had called the administrators in. With today's deficit figures, it's likely we'll see more battles like this in the years to come. Now, to sum up what Charlie's saying there, Daphne, he's saying actually what's happening is, even though we've been guaranteed consistent funding for the health service, actually what's happening on the ground is there are quite a lot of cuts having to be go on. I mean, it seems incredible that you've got two high dependency beds put into this ward and yet they're not actually operating. There are no nurses to ensure they're working.
Well, allegedly, I mean, the trust says that they have recruited nurses, but the question is, have they got the right skilled nurses there to be able to run those beds? But I think there's two things. So if you look at things like Lewisham Hospital and the need to have services close to people, accident, emergency, etc., that is a different thing to this, which is paediatric cardiac care. It's a very specialist service, and the recommendations of the Kennedy Review, going back to 2001 in Bristol, was that it was not affordable for cities, I think there were 11 centres around the country, for those 11 centres to remain open. And it was all about looking at centralising that very specialist service to provide the safest care, but in an affordable way. And I think the question has to be asked with what's happened in relation to Bristol, where we seem to have another heart scandal on our hands, is that Bristol knew from a report that was done by one of its senior nurses in 2011 that they needed high dependency care. And actually in her report, she said that the paediatric intensive care unit was the only area within the hospital where high dependency care could be provided. So Bristol was trying to provide care but didn't have the resources. And really that raises the question of moving to this very specialist service to fewer numbers of centres, but making sure they're resourced properly, that they do have high dependency beds, they do have the right levels of staffing. And so there's a balance. But I think, yes, the NHS, it's got a financial challenge, but this whole thing with paediatric cardiac services has just been there for so many years, and nobody's got the courage to make it happen and actually get on and consolidate those services. That's how it appears to me.
Well, Sean's parents say in the Bristol Post this week, we are shocked by the verdict of the inquest. Moments before the end of the hearing into what caused the death of her four-year-old son, Yolanda Turner put 7 days of evidence into perspective. 2 years ago today, she said, Bristol asked us to bring Sean in for his Fontan surgery. He was so excited. 2 years later, we await anxiously the inquest verdict. Afterwards, Mrs. Turner expressed her disappointment at the conclusion of the shocking and unacceptable ordeal the family had been through. Now, she says this is a shocking and unacceptable ordeal. But to a certain extent, when anyone goes into hospital, Daphne, there are risks.
There are risks. And, you know, the chief executive of University Hospitals Bristol has said it's very complex, that inevitably there will be some children who don't survive. But my understanding is that although Mr. and Mrs. Turner's son, yes, he did have complex needs, but he was expected to survive this operation. And if you go back to the wording from the Kennedy Inquiry report, and I think history has repeated itself, because Professor Serene Kennedy said, parents taking their children to be treated in Bristol assumed that the level of care provided would be good. They trusted the system. And that's the case here. Yes, some children do have complex cardiac needs, but Bristol has set itself up and is inviting them to come here because it says it can care for them safely. And so it's inevitable, yes, that some children sadly will not survive, but parents and their children are entitled to expect very good quality care, and that the Trust will not cut corners in providing that care.
Well, Yolanda Turner's actually said that there were many missed opportunities to rescue Sean from his desperate situation. There did not seem to be a plan for his care, which was disjointed and, in our view, shambolic. In our opinion, Sean was in the wrong hospital with the wrong surgeon, and we now have to try and rebuild our lives without our little boy. So she's clearly not happy. What should parents do if they're worried, do you think, Daphne, about whether Bristol's a safe place for their children to be operated on, and how can parents compare the performance from different hospitals? Is that feasible?
It's not, because what Professor Kennedy said back in 2001, he said, for the future there must be two developments: agreed and published standards of clinical care for healthcare professionals to follow, so that patients and the public know what to expect. Now, those standards are not published for paediatric cardiac surgery. In fact, they're not published for anything. It's very difficult to prize information out of clinical teams about what quality of service you should expect and how they compare with other centres. And he said there must also be standards for hospitals as a whole, and hospitals which do not meet these standards should not be able to offer services within the NHS. And I think parents of children considering what hospital to take their child for paediatric care need to ask those questions of the health professionals to say, well, how are you performing? What standards do you provide? How do you compare with other centres? Because they're entrusting their children, their precious children, to the care of medical professionals. And I think those medical professionals owe them the right to explain to them what standards they get. And if for any reason they feel that they could actually get better care at another centre, maybe because another centre does more operations, maybe has high dependency and can perhaps cope better if there are complications, they should be honest and tell those parents that and give them the opportunity to go elsewhere.
No, I think it's also fair to raise some questions about the independence of the coroner, Maria Voisin, because I understand that it's Bristol City Council that actually organises the payroll and the wages and that sort of thing for the coroner's service, even though the coroner is supposed to be independent. And the legal chief for Bristol City Council is Liam Nevin, who was an ex-North Bristol NHS Trust lawyer. So, you know, there seems to be a little bit too close a connection between the coroner and the National Health Service, possibly, here in Bristol. But anyway, have regulators, the regulators are, there's quite a few, aren't there? Monitor, Care Quality Commission, NMC and the General Medical Council, done as much as they could have done in this case?
No, I don't think so. University Hospitals Bristol is a foundation trust, and it is therefore regulated by Monitor. And I've found this, as you know, Tony, when I've been on the show before over Bristol's pathology problems, which preceded what went on in the Bristol Children's Hospital. And what we've found, and I'm actually a member of University Hospitals Bristol NHS Foundation Trust, so I don't have any powers other than, in theory, to hold the board to account through the governors. But I have found that if I've raised issues with any of these regulators, they just pass the buck. They're all very good at telling you why it's not their remit. They aren't very good at telling you what they can actually do. So they just try and pass you off to, you know, go round the circle, and nobody actually takes responsibility for dealing with anything.
OK, so what was the actual setup before the Foundation Trusts came along?
Well, they all reported into the Department of Health. So the Department of Health ultimately oversaw what they were doing.
And I can remember a few years ago there was some something called community health councils, where anything to do with the health service, you just went along to the health. If you had a problem of some sort, you could at least make sure that everybody was aware of it, and they would be publish any kind of problems and possible complaints that there could be. Is there any such service these days, Daphne, which does a similar job to the old community health councils used to do?
No, and cynics might say they did away with the community health councils because they worked. I don't know too much about them, except that I've heard that that's the one thing that people have said really worked, and then they were succeeded by local involvement networks, which haven't worked very well. Now they're succeeded by Health Watch, from what I've seen so far, I don't think they're going to be particularly helpful in holding NHS organisations to account.
Okay, so I mean, one of the things you're doing is you're keeping an eye on these foundation trusts. How transparent are they?
They're not very transparent at all. In theory, they look as if they're transparent because they hold board meetings in public. But the only way that the public can hold them to account is through the governors, the publicly elected governors and the patient governors. And the extent to which an NHS Foundation Trust is held to account depends on the strength of the governors. They have very strong powers to hire and fire board chairs and non-executive directors, but they are not very good, in my view, at exercising those powers.
Okay, Daphne, finally, just give us an idea of how people can get in touch with you if they want to either just have a chat or even blow the whistle.
There's our website.
Okay, you just handed me a little card. Yep. It's Southwest Whistleblowers Health Action Group. I really pronounce this. I better pronounce it correctly.
Swag.
Swag. Swag.
Swag.
Okay. Phone number 07971 968244. That's 07971 968244. And you'll find, if you put into an internet search engine SWWHAG, you'll find Daphne's blog at a WordPress blog right there. So Daphne Havercroft from Schwag, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony.
Driving home with BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
Well, I'm joined by Kevin Phillips from the Avon and Somerset Police Federation now. Hi, Kevin, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Good evening, Tony.
Now, I've noticed over the last couple of weeks there's been a lot of questions about the Police Federation. An article in The Guardian I've got in front of me here says the Police Federation needs to change. A review is to say, in the wake of the Plebgate scandal, the rank and file body admits it needs to be more accountable about funding on the eve of the Independent Report's publication. Now, this is from just a few days ago. Can you bring us up to date on the report of the publication of the report? And also, is this something that the Federation itself is calling for?
Well, I suppose what we've got to try and do to start with is separate the issues. The Plebgate is a totally separate issue to the independent review, if I'm totally honest. Many of the Federation representatives around the country have been calling for a change and a review as to how the Federation works.
OK, Okay. Yes, but okay. So with the review, I think it's very difficult to disconnect these people things in people's minds, because when ever there's a review looking closely at the Police Federation, they're bound to look at news stories. I mean, many people would never hear of the Police Federation if it wasn't for stories like the Plebgate story. So what's happening with this review anyway? What's the latest?
Well, basically, the review was published on Monday, about lunchtime on Monday. We all got the same opportunities to actually look at that review. There is 36 recommendations within the review for the Police Federation to look at. There is a timetable of approximately 2 years before the review suggests that all these recommendations are implemented. April 2016 is the target that they're looking at.
Okay, so for you, completely independently, as the chair of the local Police Federation, what's your thoughts about how the organisation needs to change and why?
I think there's lots of things that need to change within the organisation. Probably one of the biggest ones is the funding stream. Clearly, and I suppose we've got to look back in history, the Police Federation was set up in 1919. It was set up basically to fail. It was 43 different local branch boards. So if you looked at this in a business sense, you are looking at 43 separate businesses with a common, you know, a common aim, a common issue to deal with. Now, what's happening is there is a system where the funding, all the subscriptions that come from the Police Federation members, 70% would go to the centre and 30% remains local to be dealt with on local issues.
Okay, and how do you get on with your neighbouring organisations? Obviously, people like Gloucestershire, Wiltshire, South Wales.
I think if you actually look at it, on a regional basis, we've got a very good working relationship with all our regional colleagues. Interestingly enough, I'm actually having a meeting on Tuesday lunchtime with my regional colleagues to discuss this review and try and work out a regional tact on where we're going to deal with it.
Okay. What about the actual cause for this in the first place? Who is it, and why has it happened? This call for a change.
I think basically, and this was actually called for back in 2012, December 2012, and this followed on from the Andrew Mitchell issue. Now, the incoming chairman at the time, I suppose you would class him as a chair-elect, and the national chair-elect, decided in 2012, because of the issues of the Andrew Mitchell and, as you call it, the Plebgate, there needed to be some sort of, or some form of way to deal with the issues, and effectively it's very difficult how to phrase that, but he could see it coming, and the issue was either we do it to ourselves or somebody else is going to do it to us, and clearly the government would do it to us.
Okay, so I hope it's not too painful. Anyway, the whole point here, isn't it, is to actually have a Police Federation that represents individual officers. Don't you think sometimes you are essentially just a trade union? Why don't you just get rid of the old system of state funding and go to get money from individual police's pay? Or is that the way you're funded as it is?
I mean, that is the way it's done as it is at the moment. You know,
so it's effectively like a trade, just like a trade union, but it's in a statutory form.
Yes, exactly. You know, the statutes, it's law, it was formed by an Act of Parliament, was the Police Federation, and that is how it's done. Every month, the subscriptions are taken out of each police officer's wage packets. It goes to the local officers, and then that is then sent on to the national board.
Now, there's another big issue coming along. I mean, I've spoken to a couple of superintendents in Avon and Somerset Police who haven't yet got back to me about whether they want to come along and speak about it on the radio, because it's going to affect their higher ranks a lot more. But what's the Police Federation's view on this whole idea of bringing in, shall we say, corporate bosses and also police from other parts of the world into these top police jobs? Because traditionally, you've had to work your way up, haven't you, from police constable right the way up to the top?
Absolutely. The Police Federation's view has been all out, we're dead against it, we do not want this. You cannot have direct entry into the police service for people that don't actually know anything about policing. They will never have the respect of the lower ranks, so to speak.
But don't you think that there's a... I mean, the argument, which is always used here, is that the police is far too insular. That actually what happens is, after people have been within the police service for a long time, they start to think far more about protecting police officers than they do about protecting the public.
Yeah, I mean, I think my biggest example would be the last couple of years when we had the disorder down in Soaks Croft outside Tesco's. Now, you would have had to have had there a commander, somebody on the ground to actually deal with that. Now, if you've got, and I use Tesco's there, if you had the local Tesco's manager that's just come in as direct entry, would he know how to deal with those issues and how to deal with those situations?
But don't you accept that sometimes the priorities of senior police are to look after other police rather than to look after the public? That they become a bit too insular. I mean, it doesn't help, does it, having your headquarters over in Portishead, which is sort of miles from anywhere, out on the top of a hill, looking down from the top of a hill on the countryside, almost like a sort of castle, medieval castle, you know, looking down. Actually, you're not really, as a senior police officer working up at Portishead, really in touch with people on the street.
I suppose to a point I would actually agree with that. I'm glad to say I didn't have any choice on where the headquarters was built. You know, personally, I think it should be in the city centre, the main city centre. We've got these issues coming up. It's the same as coming up towards the end of next week. We're going to have the new operating model, which is going to cover lots of things and changes within Avon and Somerset Constabulary. We're going to have to wait and see how that works, because it's going to affect a lot of people.
Okay, so a new operating model. First, I've heard of that. Tell us what you know about it, how things are likely to change.
Well, effectively, and I will quote the Chief Constable from back at the beginning of December, he said this will affect 7 out of 10 police officers or police staff as to either where they work, their managers, who they're going to work under, etc. Now, I'm aware that that's been changed slightly, and that's been downed a little bit, that it won't affect that many people, but it's still going to change the way that we police in Avon and Somerset.
How?
Well, the idea is that it is supposed to put more cops on the beat, more cops on the streets. I'm still holding my breath on that one, because I'm not 100% sure where that's going to come.
But we always hear that, don't we? We always hear that, and I never actually seem to see more police actually walking the streets.
Well, I think that's going to be my view on it, if I'm honest. You know, I know this operating model will be coming in. It will be launched on the 29th of January. We wait to see how it's going to work. Clearly, there's going to be cuts in budgets, and the proof will be in the pudding. Do we get more cops out on the street?
Now, what about this rumour that's been circulating in the form of news on the Bristol Post website and in the paper about the possible closure of Trinity Road Police Station?
Yeah, I'm fully aware of that one. Clearly, I've spoken on the media with regards to that. I have seen documentation that clearly said that Trinity Road Police Station would be closing due to financial reasons. The organisation have said it will not be closing in the imminent future. What is the imminent future? Again, that probably links back to the operating model that's coming up and how we do things. My concerns with regards to all of that are, for one, the communities that live around Trinity Road Police Station and the officers and staff that work there, because they don't know what's going on.
Well, this doesn't help things, doesn't it? But also, what I'd heard or what I'd read was that actually that they were thinking about closing, first of all, the custody suite at Trinity Road, and then possibly the station itself.
Yes, I mean, the biggest issue that you've got at the moment is there's currently being built three super custody suites within the Force area, Patchway, Keynsham and Bridgewater. Clearly, once those custody suites have been built, then you're going to have little need for the other custody suites in Bath, Bristol, you know, Southmead, Trinity Road, Broadbury Road, etc. I don't know how they're going to work it. I can see that there's going to be some savings to be made on selling the estate off. Interestingly enough, I heard a rumour today, and I stress it is only a rumour, that Trinity Road has already been sold to with regards to a school.
Goodness me, crikey. Okay, interesting to hear. I hope it is just a rumour, Kevin. Finally, tell me about morale. You're in touch day to day with a lot of... I mean, you probably get some of the worst end of police experience. People come to you as a Federation representative when things go wrong, for whatever reason, within the police service around here. What is morale like generally? You've been doing this for a little while. How are things these days? And maybe you can give us a couple of examples of the sorts of things which are worrying, or even... if possible, actually getting police excited and making them feel a bit more positive.
I think you've touched on it perfectly. Morale is at rock bottom. Morale has been at rock bottom for the last few years. It's quite interesting that the chief constable, and you're probably aware he's very much into social media, etc., and he did actually do a visit to Trinity Road this week. And I think if you saw his Twitter account, it said morale was about 5.4. Now, not being funny, but if a chief constable walks into a briefing room and asks you how you're feeling, I'm pretty sure you're not going to turn around and say, pretty crap at the moment, you know what I mean?
Okay, just explain to us then, why is this? I mean, is this just simply because of the Conservative government cuts and the fact that there's, because of those, there's quite a lot of uncertainty, Kevin?
I think it is the uncertainty, and I think it does come from this current coalition government that have come into power and they've certainly had a go at the police service. They've gone for the police service and it's been an endless attack on the police service. This has affected the morale of all police officers.
Okay, so what about recruitment? Is there any recruitment going on in Avon and Somerset at the moment? Because this is one of the things, it's really important for people to feel that they've got good young people coming in through into the service.
There's currently a number of courses recently started up at police headquarters, and they're actually doing their initial training. There is recruitment going on. Whether that actually counteracts the numbers of police officers leaving at this moment in time is another matter.
But isn't this just sour grapes? Don't we always get a bit of this, Kevin, from the police? They're always saying, we're not quite being looked after enough, haven't quite got enough pay, we haven't quite got enough people to do the job.
I think you're always going to get that, but effectively you're going to get what you pay for. And I know Sue Mount Stevens was he's actually looking at a rising the precept to pay for policing. Now, my personal opinion, I would have been happy to pay 10%, not the 2%, and I think I've had those discussions with her.
But the thing is, this is something that everybody's got to pay, Kevin, and obviously somebody somewhere has decided, we can't ask everybody in Bristol to pay this extra amount, but certainly not 10%.
Oh, no, I do understand where the costs come into it, but when you actually look at how much that would cost throughout the county, I mean, you've got to look at what do people want. And I know that the chief constable clearly keeps going on about prioritising what we do and what we don't do. Now, we're already looking at a new Triforce collaboration between Wiltshire and Gloucester on a number of the issues like firearms, dog sections and things like that. Again, it's a way of cutting costs and it's a way of saving money.
Okay, back to the policing review, because Theresa May has criticised the Police Federation for taking partisan and political positions. Do you think you will continue to take partisan and political positions, and will you continue to irritate the Home Secretary?
I think some of the things that have happened with the Home Secretary over the last few years have been wrong, in my personal opinion. I think some of the things have been out of order. If we actually look back at the Plebgate, that is a small minority. And as I said, I went back to what I said right at the beginning, there's 43 separate branch boards. They are not controlled by one chairman. They have a right to do what they choose to do, and a small number of them chose to do what they did with Plebgate.
Another big thing in the background of all this is there's constant attempts, and I can remember for the last 10 years, to get police forces around the country to merge. The other thing, I mean, yes, privatised, but mergers between local forces. Do you think that's going to happen in this part of the world, Kevin?
I don't think it will happen in the next 10 years. I do not fall out with it. You've only got to look at the Scottish model at the moment. All the Scottish police forces have actually merged and they are one big organisation. I think it's a good idea. I think, if you're looking at cost savings, it's bound to make savings.
But you would, for example, as Avon and Somerset, would lose your independence, wouldn't you? Not only as a police federation, but also the chief constable would.
Most certainly the chief constable would. I think if you merged all the forces, all 43 forces throughout the country, you would still have a requirement for a chief constable. But invariably, there would be somebody above that person. And I think, you know, it's a way forward. I'm not saying it would happen. We tried it a few years back with regionalisation, and I remember a few years back, and that was never going to get off the ground.
Well, Kevin Phillips, chairman, in fact, of Avon and Somerset Police Federation, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Drive Time on BCFM 93.2.
And now I'm joined by Mike Birkin from Southwest Friends of the Earth. Hi, Mike. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Good evening, Tony.
First of all, let's talk floods, because the Somerset levels have been flooded, haven't they, for the last 2 or 3 weeks. And I want to know, is this all due down to climate change, global warming, or is it just a natural event?
It's complicated. The history of the levels is that a lot of the area has been allowed to flood during winter, but what has happened over the last few years is that increasingly it seems flooding has been worse than it has been at previous historic levels. So we're seeing villages cut off, roads isolated, farms inundated, businesses having to be abandoned, people living in misery for weeks at a time. And it's happened 2 out of the last 3 years now, and people are saying, well, you know, there are memories going back 100 years and people living in houses that have been there for 100 years that haven't flooded before. So clearly something is changing. It's a very contentious issue down on the levels. Some people are pointing the blame very squarely at the Environment Agency for having ceased to dredge some of the rivers down there, but the Environment Agency are defending themselves and saying it's a more complicated issue than that. And whatever the circumstances of this particular set of floods may be, all the signs are that with a climate changing future, then this is going to happen more frequently.
Now, I've been wandering around near West Hay last weekend on the levels. I noticed on my map there's a little thing saying floating villages. Actually, what used to happen on the levels is that there were floating villages around on the levels where they spent actually the whole of the winter flooded. And so, in a way, maybe what we're doing is just reverting back to what happened before the levels were drained.
Well, yeah, we clearly do need to adapt to a different future, but that's got to be planned. What's concerning us about the way that things are happening at the moment is that the government is actually responding by cutting flood defence funding. There's been some ding-dongs about that in Parliament. But
well, I think 1,500 people being cut from the Environment Agency in terms of actual members of staff, many of whom, of course, work on rivers and flood defences, and also grants being cut for flood defences themselves.
We've seen figures of 500 Environment Agency staff who work on flooding, their jobs at risk.
Well, a third of the redundancies were actually the flooding people. Well,
People who, in one way or another, one time or another, will be involved in response to floods or planning to
absolutely
to combat floods.
Amazing, yeah. Really. So do you think, come on, give us your little crystal ball opinion. I mean, I don't know if you've got a crystal ball up in the Southwest Friends of the Earth office, but whether you think that the current situation with levels being very, very boggy, many parts of it impassable, is this just a matter of time before the levels drain again? Like the next few weeks or something?
Oh, well,
we're going to have to be looking at a long time of muddy puddles and
yes, in the floods that happened in the summer of 2012, water was standing around in the levels for weeks on end. There's more rain coming this weekend, so it could be weeks of misery still to come for people down on the levels.
So what should we be doing? If Friends of the Earth was in charge, if you were sitting in Owen Paterson's and our Environment Minister's Secretary's shoes, what would you be doing?
I think I'd certainly be looking at a long-term solution rather than just kind of think, oh gosh, you know, here's another year, here's floods, here's the 1 in 100 year flood that came last year and it's coming again this year. I think you'd have to start planning and saying, well, we need to figure out, you know, what is the long-term prognosis here and what are the potential solutions that we can bring to bear on it. So it could be that, you know, it's just a question of spending a lot of money on it, increasing the technology, bigger rivers, more pumps, that kind of thing. But maybe actually that is, when you look at the whole, across the country as a whole, the amount of areas that are under threat of flooding, maybe we can't afford to do that in all places. That there's maybe a smart solution which gives us a double win on the Somerset levels, which is to build a barrage across Bridgewater Bay, which would be an energy generating scheme as well as a flood defence scheme.
But wouldn't
that
keep the water in, Mike, and mean that levels would flood even more?
It would allow manipulation of the tide level, because one of the problems you have on the levels is that quite a lot of the areas are, you know, below or only just above sea level. So the water can only drain out of the levels into the Severn at low tide. So if you had a barrier that separated the Bridgewater Bay from the majority of the Severn estuary, you might be able to manipulate the levels and allow water to drain.
You'd actually be able to close it whilst when the tide came in and allow the levels to be draining when normally they wouldn't be able to drain. What a good idea.
And which would also give you a major energy, clean energy generating system.
Fantastic.
Well.
So, you know, well, maybe for a few days or weeks a year, you wouldn't be able to use it for your energy because you'd be using it to help the levels drain. But the rest of the year, we wouldn't need that new nuclear power station.
True.
Okay. Anyway, the other topic, hot topic at the moment, of course, is fracking. Mm. It seems to be moving ahead over at the World Economic Forum, which Martin and I are going to chat about in a minute, in Davos in Switzerland, up on the high mountain like a bunch of Bond villains. The Davos people are talking, David Cameron is talking, and he's saying fracking is the future. It's the way forward. He's prepared to subsidise it.
Yeah. He clearly is. He's saying that fracking should go, it's all go for fracking in the UK. Now, he's taking an enormous gamble because we don't have any sort of track record to go on here. There's no history of shale gas exploration and extraction in Britain. We don't know what the economics of it will be. Still less do we know what the environmental effects it would be. What we do know is that in the areas where it's been proposed, it's proved to be extremely unpopular. So it has it provoked a lot of protests, not only from people coming outside the area to set up protest camps and so on, but local residents have been very, very concerned about the effects it might have in their areas. So it's not proved to be a very easy thing to win hearts and minds over. And I can honestly say I don't blame local people for being extremely suspicious.
So what about these rumours of earthquakes, rumours of water supplies being poisoned?
Well, earthquakes did happen. It wasn't a rumour when fracking took place in Lancashire near Blackpool. The year before last, there were small earth tremors. They weren't big tremors, but they were. People could feel them. People are able to point to minor damage in their houses. So obviously, it did cause concern. And if fracking was going to be going ahead large scale, that was maybe just the tip of an iceberg, that there would be much more seismic activity, many more earthquakes to follow. Water contamination, again, there's very good evidence where fracking has happened in the USA on a big scale, that there have been many incidents of water contamination, wells failing, frack water, which is extremely dirty and contains toxic elements, getting into groundwater supplies.
Radiation as well, radioactive elements I've seen as well. But I mean, the government have said that if people do get these effects, for example, their houses start having cracks appearing, they get shaking, earthquakes, and if their water is contaminated, that they'll be compensated.
Well, that's very nice. I mean, very comforting. The difficulty is you've got to prove it. And unless there's really good baseline data that says this is what the groundwater is like now, this is what the seismic activity is like now, how are you going to be in a position in future to show that it has changed? And how are you going to be able to say that you can definitely pin that on the fracking activity in the area? So I wouldn't set much store by government assurances that they will compensate for downsides of fracking, because it's going to be a hell of a legal battle to ever get that compensation.
So where are the hotspots around Bristol? We keep hearing about the Mendips, but anywhere else, and where exactly in the Mendips?
Well, what's happening now is that the government is in the process of issuing a whole new round of exploration licences, which will allow the oil and gas companies to apply for the rights to extract oil and gas, and then to apply planning permission to put in fracking wells. Pretty much anywhere across Gloucestershire, Somerset, Wiltshire. So the whole area is now sort of up for grabs. Previously, there has been concentration on the Chew Valley, Mendips, and the area around Keynsham, and these have been the sort of anticipated hotspots, but as yet, the one application was withdrawn, hasn't come back, so as yet there are no actual applications to put the wells in, but they could come any day.
I suppose the $64,000 question is, Mike, if people are concerned, is Friends of the Earth organising meetings, or is there anything that you would suggest that people can actually go and attend in person to learn more?
There are certain to be meetings. There's the best way to keep in touch with what is happening is through the Frac Free network. So there's a Frac Free Bristol, a Frac Free Somerset. You can find those organisations on the web. But by all means, do get in touch with Friends of the Earth, because we will also be monitoring and publicising what we know of in terms of meetings, continue to put out information. So get in touch with Southwest Friends of the Earth and we will help.
Okay, another couple of websites. There's one fairly newly set up, which is called www.gasfieldfreemendip.org, campaigning against fracking for shale in the Mendips, and which is a map of where these things are likely to take place. And then another one, not quite so polite, called Get the Frack Out of the Mendips on Facebook. Interesting to have you two, both Kevin Phillips and you, Mike, from Friends of the Earth, because I am hoping that we're not going to have the sort of conflicts that we've seen at Balcombe and other sorts of places here in the Mendips, and that people just take a sensible decision about, let's do this with the public consent rather than against the public consent. So Mike Birkin from Southwest Friends of the Earth, thanks very much for joining us again.
You're welcome.
Drive Time on BCFM 93.2.
Martin, Davos, this is the villain's palace on the top of a mountain in Switzerland. We hear this week that the from Oxfam, that the 85 richest people, many of whom are actually at Davos, are as wealthy as the poorest half of the world. And yet they're talking about the wealth divide. Unbelievable.
Yeah, Will Self, the author, said they talk about inequality and then give all the money to the rich.
So what is this Davos meeting? We have, it's a sort of slightly larger version of the Bilderberg conference we have in the summer, at the sort of end, towards the end of the winter. Davos is a much more public event, but it has an equal amount of wealth really represented there.
Well, it's a bigger event altogether. As you know, Bilderberg, famous for being secretive, Davos is in your face. I mean, they're standing on
the
top of the
mountain. Well, it's in your face, but it's right out the Midland,
in the middle of nowhere, so that the protesters find it very difficult to get to. It's become a yearly gathering of the global elite and their hangers-on.
What about the idea that they are actually starting to tackle this idea of the wealth divide? Do you think that that's a serious
Talking about it, but they're talking about it in a sort of hand-wringing fashion. Oh dear, what can we do? The reality is that what they're trying to push at Davos this year is that the world economy is being fixed, and that everybody should just knuckle under, tighten their belts, and it'll all become all right in the end. That's the usual sort of guff that you get from these.
Mark Carney, for example, today has been telling Davos that the UK economy is well short of escape velocity. I'm not sure quite what that has to do with the space program, Wernher von Braun and the Saturn rockets.
He's being honest there, which is that a brief spurt of growth in Britain is not the end of the road. It doesn't mean, you see, there's no guarantee that this will continue. There's all sorts of potential shocks. The Baltic Dry Index, which is basically looks at the price of putting stuff on ships, and that has taken a massive dive since the beginning of the year, and the last time it did that was before the crash in 2008. So, I mean, I must admit I tend to read the more pessimistic people like Nouriel Roubini and so on, but frankly most mainstream economists and city types did not predict the crash in 2008. Some of them probably knew it was coming but didn't care, and when people I respect say that there's a potential for a crash here now, and I look at the situation, I think the potential for a crash is absolutely there.
But isn't it the fact that a lot of people, almost all the people at Davos, have done very nicely? It's not been a crisis for them at all.
Well, that's why nothing's been done to solve the crisis, because those who caused the crisis, by and large, have benefited from the crisis. So they're not in that much of a hurry to solve the crisis, because it's worked out rather well for them. A controlled crisis is perfect for the global elite, because they can then turn round and say to the kind of people we've had on the show tonight, to police officers, to the environmentalist community, to people who want more money spent on the NHS, yes, but there's a crisis, so we can't give you any money. Meanwhile, of course, they've actually made more money, in that the crisis has proved to be more profitable for the global elite than the run-up to the crisis, and they were making out like bandits before the crisis, and they made out even more so subsequently. And I was looking at some very interesting stats about the level of profits in the world. Profit margins have gone up. The share of profits in national income has massively increased over the last few years during the crisis. Now, this is supposed to encourage people to invest more because they're making profits, but as I said last week, what's actually happening is profit-taking is going on and no new investment is taking place, because everything has been geared now simply to making short-term profits for the elite.
Andre,
investment of the future is not being taken seriously.
Andre Damon on the World Socialist website, also on the Global Research website, is saying corporate criminals and billionaires are gathering for the World Economic Forum in Davos. Are they really criminals?
Some of them, definitely. There's no doubt about it. Don't presume. You see, some of the problems we have are political problems, and you can change them by voting for different people, perhaps, and that's the way forward. A lot of what's gone on in the financial sector is literally criminal, and the problem is that they are unprosecutable, because any attempt to prosecute the criminals will lead to a situation where they just say, well, the system will collapse. So you're in a double bind here. Any attempt to really get to the heart of criminality in financial markets would probably crash those markets. So we're probably going to have to wait until the markets have crashed and then clean up afterwards, mopping up.
Okay, what about down the hill then in Montreux and Geneva, the peace talks between the Syrian government and effectively the rebels, basically, all overseen by the United Nations? Because I noticed we had this accusation of 11,000 people being tortured this week by the Assad regime, and also, equivalently, a Massachusetts Institute of Technology report that says it looks almost certain now that the gas attack, the chemical weapons or WMD attack that nearly sparked an attack or even possibly an invasion of Syria actually came from a rebel-controlled area. So we're getting both sides, polarisation of the propaganda.
Yes, and I think the most significant aspect of Geneva is that the Ban Ki-moon invited the Iranian government and then uninvited them because of pressure from the US. Meanwhile, of course, the Saudi Arabians and the Qataris and so on, who are supplying weaponry to the rebels, and the British and the Americans, who are also been supplying all sorts of aid to the rebels, they are allowed to come to the meeting. In other words, nobody's really looking for a solution here apart from the Russians, I think. The Syrian government's position, I think, is we'll go to this meeting if our Russian allies suggest that we should, but we don't expect to be able to get any sense out of these rebels. And in actual fact, most of the rebel factions are not represented anyway.
Okay, a few more stories also. DVN shares surge as former Blackwater owner is named as their chairman. Now, DVN Holdings, controlled by Hong Kong businessman Johnson Ko Chunson and state-owned Citic Group, surged 7.3% after it appointed Eric Prince, that's the Blackwater XE chairman, as their chief. Now, tell us a bit about this company, because they seem to be involved a lot with the Chinese government. This is almost like a Blackwater, only this time they're working for China.
Yes, well, he seems to be selling his services to the highest bidder. The Chinese seem to be prepared to employ this, basically, war criminal. You mentioned, are they criminals? Prince is a criminal. I don't think there's any doubt about that. He's also a fundamentalist Christian, which is very strange. So a lot of the people that were
training... He doesn't sound like one.
No, he is, Tony.
Maybe a far-right fundamentalist.
Yes, well, he is. He's one of those. And many of the people who were sent to Iraq were given instructions that killing Muslims was good.
This kind of fundamentalist attitude, which is... to do with a kind of twisted version of Christianity where, oh, we've got this kind of Western influence in the Middle East and that is what God wants.
Well, I mean, it was worse than that. It was saying that, you know, if you kill Muslims, you're doing a good deed. I mean, that's how unprofessional, if you like, they were and still are. The fact that the Chinese are doing business with them, I find a bit of a question mark over that. But don't forget, the Chinese will want to be trying to... They're having a struggle to get their investments and so on in Africa recognised by the West. So in a way, what the Chinese want is just to be allowed to buy raw materials, which they're after, without having a big row with the West. So if they bring in Eric Prince as sort of security, it's a kind of, you know, a way of trying to guarantee that their stuff won't be messed with by the Western powers. But I would suggest to the Chinese, would you trust Eric Prince to manage your security when he's actually his real loyalty is elsewhere? I wouldn't trust him as far as I could spit.
Another story: the DEA negotiated with Mexican drug cartel members in a report in the Huffington Post. Agents of the US Drug Enforcement Administration and Justice Department officials met in secret with members of the Mexican drug cartels in exchange for information on rival drug organizations. According to the report, US agents held more than 50 secret meetings with cartel operatives on Mexican territory between 2000 and 2012 without informing Mexican authorities. I mean, sounds like they're working... This is the Drug Enforcement Agency working incredibly close with the super criminals they're supposed to be policing, Martin.
Yeah, well, what's happened along... most people in Latin America are very aware of this, that the US basically plays favourites with drug cartels. So when Pablo Escobar was gunned down some years ago now, he was the head of the Medellin cartel, and basically the US's interests were being protected by the Cali cartel. So what you've actually got is the way the drug enforcement system works is that the law enforcement people go after those who are not politically connected. Those who play ball with the US's geopolitical goals, they get a nod and a wink. And this all goes back to the Iran-Contra affair in the 1980s, which might have been called the Contra-Cocaine affair, more realistically. That's cooperation between US law enforcement and secret services and the drug cartels is documented and has gone on for years.
Okay, finally, Ukraine and Kiev. What are your thoughts about what's been going on there? Apparently a British Metropolitan Police officer said if it happened in London, we'd have to do the same.
Well, that's right. I mean, the fact is there's an elected government in Ukraine. Some people don't like them. They're not necessarily the favour of the month for some Ukrainians either. But I would hope Ukraine, unlike Egypt, will resolve its differences through political dialogue and elections, not through fighting in the streets.
That sounds like one way of doing it. What's your prediction? Which way is it going to go? Do you think the government is going to be overthrown? Because we only had an election last year. It looks like there's going to be another one this year. Elections out the window then in Ukraine?
No, there will be elections. I think it's going to... The people who are pushing for change, what you've got is a very divided society in Ukraine. The West Ukraine, where they speak Ukrainian, is basically a very different country from East Ukraine, where many people speak Russian.
Well, Marina Morris was saying the older generation, a lot of them are pro-Russian, look to the East, yeah. And the younger people look to the West.
Yes, so you've got a division, a generational division. It's also a cultural division to do with people's language skills. And also it's an economic division, because the East of Ukraine is the Donbass basin, is very much old-fashioned heavy industry, which would probably go in any kind of EU deal. And of course, there's a geopolitics of all of this. The Russian Black Sea Fleet uses the Crimea as its base, and the Ukrainians, if they join NATO and the EU, that will mess up Russian geopolitical strategy. So there's a potential for a war in Ukraine, like in Yugoslavia.
Okay, Martin, thanks very much. Time to sign off now. Hopefully, some Cyrus the Virus after the news. The Murdoch News at 7. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, Lib Dem leader on Bristol City Council, Councillor for Whitchurch Park, Tim Kent. Also to Daphne Havercroft, Mike Birkin, Kevin Phillips, and Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. I'm Tony Gosling. Find us online at thisweek.org.uk.
This is Bristol's BCFM.